Thank you. My name is Frank, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm pleased to be here. This is kind of an unusual event because I know everybody, or most of the people here, and where I usually do this, I don't know anybody. And I was looking forward to coming to this one. Saturday, I was in Cincinnati. We let a little blood spill in Cincinnati, and I think this is a different crowd, so I understand that there are a lot of people here who have never seen Alcoholics Anonymous. They've never seen the people of Alcoholics Anonymous, the procedure of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the ceremony of Alcoholics Anonymous. And those are the husbands and the wives and the mothers and the fathers and the children that are here. I'm an alcoholic. This is what alcoholics look like. You see, before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a perception of what an alcoholic looked like, and it wasn't this. Although, let me make one thing perfectly clear. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not look like this. I was 34 years of age. I'm now 56. I've been sober since November 3rd, 1971. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I weighed 240 pounds of... I don't know. And I looked older than I look today. I had a perception in those days, and before November 3rd, 1971, of what an alcoholic looked like, and I knew, even at my worst, I did not meet that perception. Even at my worst, I did not look like an alcoholic would look in my mind's eye. What does an alcoholic look like? Well, I do this around the country where I will get a newcomer and I'll ask them to close their eyes and picture an alcoholic. And I've done that so many times I don't even want to guess as to how many. And here's what invariably that newcomer will picture, man or woman. They will picture a skid row bum, a dirty old man. And I will tell you that in 1970 and 69 and 68, while I was training for this appearance, had you asked me what an alcoholic looked like, I would have told you and pictured and described to you pretty much the same thing that the newcomer does. Well, if you're not familiar with Alcoholics Anonymous, let me tell you, 0.1% of all the alcoholics alive today live in a skid row environment. The vast majority are in your operating rooms doing surgery, flying your jet planes, sitting in Congress voting on your future. The vast majority of alcoholics are in boardrooms of the largest corporations in this country. They're in the homes raising babies. The largest number of alcoholics are in the game, and you wouldn't know they're in the game unless you were one of their intimates, one of those secret, quiet people that live with them and share their secrets. So the perception that the alcoholic is a skid row bum never existed and does not exist today. If you're a mother or father of an alcoholic, and I know that Mr. and Mrs. Ravella, I've never met you. I don't believe. Maybe we did. We met in the Lamont Oaks Open some years ago, didn't we? I haven't changed, have I? I'm kind of timeless, you know. I just you look good too. I always have to add that, you know. Parents don't make alcoholics. Parents do not cause alcoholism. Okay? Children do not cause alcoholism. Bad breaks and misunderstandings do not cause alcoholism. The wrong wife or husband does not cause alcoholism. The erroneous judgment in choosing a career does not cause alcoholism. In 1955, after a lot of research and a lot of argument, the American Medical Association and the National Psychiatric Institute agreed for the first time that alcoholism was a disease. And there never has been that proclamation before. All of history, alcoholism was a misunderstood malady. And early records would indicate that acute alcoholics were literally people they just put away. They just put them away for their own safety and for the embarrassment of the community. Alcoholism is a disease, it is an illness, and it is similar if you're a loved one of the alcoholic. In the book Alcoholics Anonymous, in the early members of Alcoholics Anonymous, in the doctor's opinion of Alcoholics Anonymous, all of which I think some of you know what I'm talking about, it is described as an allergy. Alcohol does something special to me that it doesn't do to my wife or my daughter. Alcohol has a special effect on me. It doesn't do that to them or her and a lot of the people in this room. You see, most of the people in the world drink alcohol. It's not uncommon that people drink alcohol. And some people drink it from the time they're children. In France, for example, youngsters are taught to eat with alcohol. They use alcohol to wash down their bread. And the incidence of alcoholism in France is no higher than it is in the United States. The use of alcohol does not cause alcoholism. Now, the wonderful thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is we don't have any idea, nor do we spend any time here, trying to discern what was the cause of alcoholism. We don't do that. We don't care about that. We don't understand that. Nobody understands that. Now, there's an argument that there's some genetics in that. It appears for the loved one, it appears that alcoholism sometimes goes through families. There seems to be some argument and some credibility to the fact that alcoholics beget alcoholics who beget alcoholics. But that is a generalization that does not have to be true and is not a rule. It's an appearance, and sometimes I wonder if it's a credible appearance. Although if you hear the stories of alcoholics who come to us, you will hear often the fact that they had a parent or a grandparent who had a severe drinking disorder. Whether or not they're alcoholic, I don't know. You see, alcoholism is a self-diagnosed illness. You see, I've never been in the hospital. Nobody's ever diagnosed me an alcoholic. I've never been in a treatment center. My God, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, they didn't have a hell of a lot of treatment centers. There was a few. The old ones, Joe, you know. You would know. I mean, no, but Joe would know because Joe's a player in Alcoholics Anonymous. He pays attention to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he understands the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's the only reason that I refer that to Joe. Plus, he is kind of old. But in the early days, and I'm not an old-timer in Alcoholics Anonymous, in the early days in the Chicagoland area, there were only one or two places you could bring an alcoholic for medical treatment. You see, the reason was there was no coverage for alcoholism. You couldn't get an insurance company to pay the cost of treatment for an alcoholic. Only after the disease definition was and label was placed on alcoholism did the insurance industry decide that maybe they would insure this illness. And then all of a sudden, when the money became available, treatment centers just grew like mushrooms all over the world. Now those mushrooms are slowly dying because now they are withholding that money and pulling that money back because they understand that there is no treatment for alcoholism. And the misnomer is that alcohol treatment at this hospital is treatment, has now proven to be literally a sham. There is no treatment for alcoholism. You can't go someplace and get the cure from alcoholism. It is not subject to cure. Now, that may sound like bad news, but it really, maybe it is. But what Alcoholics Anonymous is a system of belief and actions by which you can live with it with no restriction or handicap. You can live a full and complete sober life. Now, I didn't know that was possible because on November 3rd, 1971, when I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought my life was over. I thought everything meaningful about my life was over. By the time I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was in my mind and in the measuring stick of a lot of people, a very successful professional person who had a great deal of what the world would define as symptoms, measures of success. I lived in a big house. I drove new cars. I took vacations. I owned property. I had investments. I was in that measure a successful business person. Now, if you have that going for you, and you also have this imaginary picture of an alcoholic, you're always at odds with the fact that you couldn't be an alcoholic. Because alcoholics don't live in big houses on top of hills with circular drives and new Cadillacs parked in front. Skid Row, West Madison Street is where alcoholics are. If you want to see an alcoholic in that measure. So even at the early stages, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I had the trappings of one who couldn't be an alcoholic. Unfortunately, the measuring stick of alcoholism isn't where you live or how you dress or what kind of school degree you have, what kind of success or failure you have in the business world, how much you have in the bank or don't have. It has nothing to do with it. And that's the truth. It has nothing to do with that. What it has to do with is what effect alcohol has on you and what happens to you in the process of trying to live with alcohol. What happens to you when you try to live with alcohol? That's what this is about. And I'll briefly, and I didn't want to do this, but Mrs. Ullman, your son told me I had to do this, and God knows he's a powerful person around here. We kid a lot, Mrs. Ullman. We do. We kid around. Don't take any of this personal. We do. We have a lot of fun. Alcoholics Anonymous is a place that's full of laughter, full of the ability to be able to kid one another without that thin skin that causes us to defend right away and to attack or to feel somehow violated. That's a freedom most of us never had before Alcoholics Anonymous. So that we do that. We play sometimes in those games. But it's just simply that. It's in good spirit. Billy said to me, tell your story. Because a lot of the people in this room, although you see them all the time or they know you, don't often hear that. And I'm so tired of doing that because in this touring thing that I do sometimes, it's like, God, I'm going to do that again. Where I would much rather just talk and have a conversation, but I guess I do that in the beginners, and I'm going to do part of what, Billy, I'm going to do part of that, and I'll do part of that but I want to ask first, and I'm going to abbreviate it though, Billy. I want to ask for my benefit, people to do something for me. How many people who have drinking problems are here who are in Alcoholics Anonymous and sober less than 6 months? Please just raise your hand. Keep them up. Okay, thank you. Now, that's one group of people that I owe a responsibility to deal with in these few minutes tonight. How many people are not in Alcoholics Anonymous, are here with someone who's in Alcoholics Anonymous, and who have never before been at an Alcoholics Anonymous function? Please raise their hand. Keep them up just so I can see. Good. Good for you. Welcome. Welcome. And this is the other group that I will address a few comments to. First, to the newcomer. Pat, I understand you're a member of the Hinsdale group. Okay? And you're a member of the Hinsdale group? And is there anybody here in the Hinsdale group that raised their hand that has less than 6 months who's never been at the beginner's class? Okay, is that it? Well, you're the cause that these people are going to hear that same old stuff. You've never been there. But I can cut my story short if I tell your story. You see, and I don't know who you are. I've never seen you before. You've never heard me speak before, right? Only on tape. Let me ask you a question. Do I look different than my tape sound? Young lady, you're going to make it. You can even skip a step. God, the power of those tapes. I have no idea how many tapes are out now, but if you said a million, I would not think that was an exaggeration. Because the power of tapes, not me, don't talk, the power of tapes universally is so dramatic that they go all over the world of people that we never ever will ever see hear those messages, not just me. Okay? And it is kind of a neat thing, and I take no personal credit, because everything I have from Alcoholics Anonymous. None of this is me. So I have no copyrights or patents on ideas. Okay? But it is kind of interesting sometimes to be walking down a beach. I was walking down a beach one day. The beach! And a guy walks up and says, "Excuse me, but I heard you talking." And we were in an elevator in a city I'd never been before. And I said, "Push 3." And the guy said, "Are you freak?" So the nice thing about it is that when you know that's going to happen or could happen, you always got to behave well. Because you have a duty to Alcoholics Anonymous. See, everyone here that's in Alcoholics Anonymous is Alcoholics Anonymous to the observer. Sometimes the people that love us and out there in the world will never see Alcoholics Anonymous. They'll only see us. And it is our responsibility as members of Alcoholics Anonymous to carry the flag of Alcoholics Anonymous in a dignified way, to be the best examples of Alcoholics Anonymous, so that newcomers like Pat who come can look at us and say it's not a place of shame. It's a place of great dignity. And if he can be an alcoholic, and if it's okay for her to be an alcoholic, then maybe it's okay for me to be one. And I don't have to spend hours and months and days and years and decades arguing with a term that I don't like. Alcoholic. Okay? When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I heard things that I did not understand. And most of my early weeks and months in Alcoholics Anonymous, I think the only thing I got out of my first meeting was hope. I think the first thing that I got out of my meeting was that there were other people like me. You see, I lived, by the time I got here, in such a small world that I have really excluded all others. All I knew is I lived in a world of secret thoughts, secret actions, and secret behavior that was slowly not becoming, or the secret was getting out. Maybe if they were still contained, I might still be there. I doubt it. but I lived in a world of secrets, and as a result, my world shrunk, and the number of people in my intimate world were fewer and fewer and fewer. And I thought I had unique thoughts, feelings, actions, needs. And when I went in that room, I heard men laugh. And I didn't think anybody would laugh about those kinds of secrets. And I felt a sense of freedom in that room, and I thought, how could they be free when they suffer a handicap? And yet they seem to just radiate power. How could they be powerful when they are involved in a weakness? They can't drink. To me, that's a weakness. On November 3rd, 1971, and that sense of power was contradictory to that weakness. So confusion was what I felt. But I remember coming home that night, and I said to my wife, you can't believe it. I mean, there was a whole bunch of them. And again, that uniqueness of being alone and how to find a bunch of people who talked like I felt and who talked about things I only thought. And they talked about it. And they said they used to drink. And they don't drink anymore. And I thought to myself, how could that be? There was a guy there who was sober 12 years, maybe. I don't remember exactly. 8 years, something. Tom. I don't know. But 8, 10, 12 years. And there was a young man who was sober 7 months. I thought to myself, 7 months? And he said he was a salesman. I mean, a salesman. How could you be a salesman and not drink? I thought to myself, there's something here. There's a secret here. There is a secret here. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous the very first day, I knew I was not hearing the whole story. I knew there was a secret. By the time I was sober a year, I knew if I would bet any amount of money that I was still not being told the whole story. They were just giving me kind of what they thought I could handle, but the secret was yet to come. When I was 10 years sober, I started to sense there were only a few people who had the secret. When I was 20 years sober, I started to come to grips with what might be the secret. In Cincinnati, Saturday night, I told the people, for the first time, I've never said this anywhere in the world, that I now know exactly what the secret is. Huh. Glad I know it. I came from a family where drinking was a problem. I don't know what connection that has to me. But I came from a family where drinking was a problem, violence was a problem, anger was a problem. I lived in a house where there was no certainty. It was a house where anything could happen at any time, and definitions continued to change sometimes at a moment's notice, dependent on my father's sobriety or degree of intoxication. And the fallout from that, because I had a mother who attacked him when he was at his worst. Now, that's not good behavior. I mean, I always thought, Mom, why don't you just leave him alone? I mean, but... And I remember that when he wasn't drinking, that he was a guy who wanted so much for me. I remember, and I say this often, that when I was a young man and I was 6 or 7 years old, my father told me that he wanted me to be somebody. And he told me that between the time I was 6 and the time I was 7 or 8, 1,000 times. He said, "Son, I work in a factory. I work in a factory, and your grandfather worked in a factory, and your uncles worked in a factory. And I don't want you working in a factory." Now, I never went to school, and no one ever went to school in our family. And you're going to go to school. And I'm going to make it possible for you to go to any school you ever wanted to go. And all I ask you to do is to study and to be somebody. And I want you to be somebody. And it's your job to be somebody. And the funny thing about that is, I know that was said out of love, but you know what I concluded when he told me that? I concluded, ma'am, that I was nobody. Now, I'm not blaming him, because I don't think he meant that. And I don't know if he said it even in that way that I could misinterpret it. But I concluded, all my earliest recollection is that I am nobody trying to be somebody. And he told me, if you are somebody, you will get the things that will enable you to be happy. And he long since had given up on the chance that he would ever get those things. But his dream was he would work 1, 2, or 3 jobs and make it possible for me and my brother to be somebody and then to be happy. Now, that's not a bad father. That is not a bad father. That's a father who does everything he can with what he's got. And we all do the best we can with what we got. And that's all we can do. And everybody comes in this world and accumulates some baggage. And some of us just can't do as well as we'd like to do, especially in the area of raising children. And God knows I didn't. But I remember having early on those feelings of inadequacy and struggle. And the world to me was a place of trial and proof, a place that I'd have to excel in order to be accepted or equal. Now, I don't know how I got those messages or made those conclusions, but I tell you it's true. And my dad told me when I was 6 or 7 that I was to be a lawyer. Because my dad was fascinated with a person he met who happened to be a lawyer. And he looked up to that person, and he liked what he saw, and he thought that's the key to happiness. And that is, he said to me, "You will be a lawyer." And he said to my brother, "You will be a dentist. And that's your job." I'm a lawyer. Not for long. That's a private joke. I've been a lawyer for 32 years, and if God lets me and everything works out, in another 2 or 3 weeks, I will be retired from the practice of law and be able to join the human race. But I've been a lawyer for 32 years, and I think that my father's urging had something to do with that. I don't blame him or don't know the connection. And it's nice in Alcoholics Anonymous, we don't have to figure these things out. I just report these things to you so you have some sense of who I am before I tell you what you really came to hear, Petty. And that is something that maybe you can use. But I say this on the road. I say, and I'll share it with those people who have never heard me before. I was told by my father what to be, and I didn't know what a lawyer was. You see, when I was 6 or 7, I didn't know what a lawyer was. Now, Timmy's been a lawyer for a lot of years, but I'll bet you when Timmy was 6 or 7, he didn't know what a lawyer was. And if I would ask Timmy, or you and Timmy would have asked me, he couldn't have, because he wasn't born. Because I'm older than Timmy, but if you would have asked me, "What's a lawyer, little Frankie?" That's a nice name, isn't that? I'm trying to get all these babies that are going to be born, like Lou's baby, and I keep bidding on, "Why don't you name him Frankie?" And nobody, even my children, won't do that. I have four grandsons. I don't even remember their names, but they're not Frankie. In a couple of weeks, I'm going to have another one, and it probably won't be Frankie. But I didn't know what a lawyer was, and you would ask me, say, listen, Frankie, what's a lawyer? I said, I don't know. And you'd say to me, what do you want to do with the rest of your life? What do you want to be when you grow up? You know what I would have said? I don't know. Maybe you want to be a fireman. I might want to be a policeman. Maybe I'll be a detective. Maybe I'll be a quarterback. Maybe I'll be a race car driver. Maybe I'll be a pilot. Okay? It would have been in that area or line that I would have answered because I knew what those things are. But when you're six, who the hell knows what a lawyer is? Well, that is true. But I'll tell you another thing. Mrs. Ravelli, I knew what I wanted to be and what I wanted to do the rest of my life from the time I was 6.5 years old. It was a August afternoon. It was a sunny day, and the girl next door and I built a tent out of some blankets. I wanted to be a gynecologist. Now, that really happened. And I'm going to... and the funny thing about that is I laugh about that, and I've said that in hundreds and hundreds of talks. Maybe I'm build it up a little bit, but it really happened. And one of the things I never ever said before, but everybody I think assumes is true, those of us that share these feelings, I was excited about what happened in that tent, but I also was ashamed. And I also knew it was a secret. So by the time I'm 6.5 years old, I'm already collecting secrets. And anything to do with sex or sexual or male or female to me is a secret from the time I'm a little boy. Now, I also learned about God when I'm 6 or 7 years old, and I learned it from a lady who came into a classroom. And she was dressed in black and white. And she told us about God, and she told us about sin, us being the other little boys and girls in the classroom. And she told us there were two kinds of sin. There was a kind of sin called venial sin. And there were a lot of venial sins. And if you told a lie, you offended God, she said. And she said, little boys and girls, if you tell a lie and you die, having offended God, God has got to punish you. And you go to a place, she said, little boys and little girls, if you die, called purgatory. And there you suffer the consequences by fire. And your punishment is fire. Now, I'm scared to death during this conversation, because I know I'm guilty. And I don't know when I'm going to die. And I hope it's not soon. And I don't like fire. And she sees the fear in my eyes. And she says, don't worry, it's not so bad. If you do those things and die, you only got to go there for 3,000 or 4,000 years. Then she came in another day and she told us about another kind of sin. I don't know. It was called mortal sin. It's a wonderful sin. It attaches itself to acts and desires that are just, well, they're very attractive to me. And she said, if you do those things and you die, you're doomed. I looked at that list of things that I knew. I wasn't so sure if I was doomed that day, but I figured I'd be doomed as soon as I could get to do some of those things, because I fully intended to do that. Now, here's the funny thing about that, Mr. Valley. I don't know if she ever said that. I don't know if those things ever took place. But I remember my feeling of me was that I am nobody, going to be somebody someday, so hopefully I can be happy. But in the meantime, I got a lot of secrets. I do stuff I'm ashamed of. I do things and want to do things and think things that no good boy thinks and does. And I know God is going to punish me. And I don't know if I'm going to be happy enough to forget about that punishment that's waiting out in the wings for me. And I don't know what I'm going to do with the rest of my life, but I'll just do the best I can. But I know I'm going to fail because the end of the line is doom. I don't know if she ever said that. I'll tell you, one day I almost had a heart attack. She walked into the class. We were about sixth or seventh grade, and she asked the girls to leave the class. She said, "Girls, leave the class. I want to talk to the boys." Now, this woman was dressed in black and white. I remember she was an old woman. She must have been 24 or 25. And she said, "Boys, God sees in the dark." Oh. I thought to myself, yeah, well, you don't see under the covers. So I made a tent. Secret. Different. Lonely. Dirty. Doomed. I don't know when I had my first drink of alcohol. I remember drinking in high school a little bit. I was in some sport, and so it was inconsistent with that sport. I went to college, and I was a fraternity type, but I knew I had to get into law school, and I needed certain grades to do that, so I had to be very careful of my conduct, having to qualify for my entry into becoming somebody in accordance with the path guaranteed to me. So I remember I had a great capacity to drink. I remember in the fraternity days, my capacity to drink alcohol was better than anybody else in that fraternity. I remember being able to go to those picnics and having 20, 30, 40 cans of Schlitz from the morning until the evening and walking. And talking and doing my thing. And they were throwing up and they were getting sick and they were... Then I was just... I thought to myself, this is not so bad, because I remember even early on, when I drank, something special happened. Now, I'll describe it from the words of ladies like you. A lot of years ago, I walked into a group of new people like yourself, and I asked them to tell me what an alcoholic was, and they didn't know. And I asked them, this was an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, I said, give me the definition of alcoholic, and they didn't know. Because there's nowhere in our literature that alcoholic is. The definition of alcoholic is. There's nowhere in our literature that is defined. So I thought it was important, if we were going to discuss alcoholism, that we would know what we mean when we speak those words, so we're on the same page. I mean, that makes sense. So I said to these newcomers, tell me what an alcoholic is, define alcoholic for me, and nobody could. So I challenged them many years ago to use the laboratory of their mind to create an alcoholic in an invisible test tube. Now, to shorten the process, I stood in that room and I held an invisible test tube. And I challenged the people who were new to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you once were in that group that many, many years ago that challenge was made, and a lot of the people in this room sat in that group or a similar group year after year when they were new to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I challenged them the same way to make an alcoholic in the laboratory of your mind in that sanctity of that meeting with that invisible test tube, and I said, put in the ingredients from your experience by which you will be able to make an alcoholic. And here's what happens in that experiment. And I've done that experiment for hundreds of thousands of people in a lot of places. And when I hold an invisible test tube and ask the newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous to make an alcoholic, here's what they put in. Fear. Anxiety. Depression, loneliness, anger, guilt, remorse, impatience, ego, inferiority, superiority. Sometimes the same person puts both of those together in the test tube. And we know that inferiority, superiority, same test tube. And they fill the test tube with what you, as normal people, non-alcoholic types, would say, well, those are just human emotions. And you're right, they are. But felt in the test tube of the human that is the alcoholic, they don't feel like just normal emotions. They are intense and magnified to the point that they are intolerable. Now, do you know what they never put in the test tube when I ask them to make an alcoholic? They never do. They never put alcohol. Now, wouldn't you think that an alcoholic would say alcohol is what causes alcoholism? The use of alcohol causes alcoholism, and therefore, if I'm going to make an alcoholic, the first thing I will do is put alcohol in the test tube. No. They know what we know. Alcohol is but a symptom of our problem. If we continue the experiment, this happens. If I am the test tube, and trust me, I was the test tube. And those emotions and things that were in the test tube weren't defined clearly. There wasn't one here and one there. They were just all mixed up, all undiscernible. You just couldn't. You just felt one, and then another day you felt another. But if you do this experiment, and now you take the alcohol, they say, oh my God, we forgot to put in alcohol. And I say, then put in some alcohol. Here's what happens to the alcoholic. You put alcohol in the test tube, that's the alcoholic. And what happens as you start to put alcohol in that test tube, if you put alcohol on top of fear, it appears that fear goes away. And that's why you will take a shy, very shy, inhibited person. And after just enough alcohol, that shy, inhibited person is fearless, loud, boisterous, the life of the party. Because alcohol does something very special to him or her that it doesn't do to this lady. If you put just enough alcohol on remorse or guilt. Do you know that I found that when I felt full of dirty secrets and I put just enough alcohol on me, I wasn't dirty. I was just getting what everybody else wished they got. And I just deserved it. I had different measuring sticks and different rules. And it was okay because I work hard and I do this and I do that and I have this rational ability to literally excuse all of my conduct. And I can't do that sober, but I can do that with just enough alcohol. There's ladies in my groups who report to me that they get prettier if they drink. Well, being on the other side of that, I can tell you that's true. Alcohol has a very special effect on people like us. It can take loneliness away. It can take anger away. It can anesthetize me. And that's why I drink. I never drank to degrade myself. I never drank to hurt someone I loved. I never said to myself, I think I will go out today and embarrass my family. I think I will go out today and come close to losing my life. I think I will go out today and run great risk. All I did was want to be able to relieve what was in me, and that was a myriad of emotions unidentifiable and not with which I could live. And alcohol did that for me, and it worked for a lot of years. And when I took alcohol in there, when I found alcohol, I found a friend. There's a funny thing that happens to people like me, though. If you keep using alcohol to dilute what's in the test tube, and you are disposed to being an alcoholic, like me, if you keep that process up long enough, a terrible thing happens. The alcohol that used to dilute and make me able to function in your world stops working. And now I have to have more and more to have it work. Or different. I have to choreograph how I drink and where I go and what I do, enabled so that I can find and recapture the ability so that I can live with these feelings and these secrets. And it stops working. And once it stops working, it'll never work again. What happens for people like me is that when it stops working, we pursue it. We don't say, oh my God, it's not working. I think I won't drink anymore. I think I'll give it up. Our need to survive requires that we pursue it to our death. We need that relief. It works. If you see a television set that, we've all seen the television set that's out of focus, how long can you sit there and watch a television set that's, how long can you? What do you have to do? What do you have to do? You got to get up and put it in focus, because it makes you crazy. We live in that television set. We live in that television set. The world as we see it goes like the television set goes to you. How could you live in that television set? You have to try to tune it. And alcohol tuned it, and it once did, and it did wonderfully. And what we try to do is to recapture that tuning ability. That's why we drink. Now, in the disease of alcoholism, if you keep pouring alcohol in after it stops working, it not only doesn't work, it not only doesn't dilute, it in fact intensifies. And that's why you see in chronic advanced alcoholism meanness you've never seen before, disorientation, distance from loved ones, anger, impatience, solitude, behavior that is unexplainable. And we witness that. How could he do that? How could she do that? And it almost looks like the person wills that. It almost looks like the alcoholic does that because he or she is evil. It really does. If you see that over and over and over again, you say, my God, what's wrong with them? They're just no good. They are powerless. They are smart. They are maybe very talented people. They don't know they have a disease. They don't know that that disease takes their judgment and turns it upside down. Do you know that at my worst, I knew that my life was bad? Do you know that at my worst, I knew that everybody in my range of influence was negatively affected by my drinking? I knew my wife wasn't happy. Linda was 9.5 years old when I had my last drink. I knew that I affected her and her two sisters. She the most, I think, because she was the oldest. I think she saw more than they did because they were younger than her. I knew that. But you know what I concluded? Why I drink? Because I don't need to have a wife and three kids. I'm too young. I work too hard. I am in a career I don't ever want to be into. I don't want to be a lawyer. What the hell am I doing here? I'm dressed in a lawyer suit and I don't even know what a lawyer is. And now I've been a lawyer and I don't know what a lawyer is. And I got to go to court not knowing what the hell a lawyer is. And I know that they know, and they look, and they expect me to act in a certain way. It's like life is a game, and I don't know the rules. There's pressure. And I know that I have a problem. I knew when I was 16 years old that I had a problem. My problem was definition, Patty. I did not know things that everybody else knew. Here's what I didn't know. I didn't know what the meaning of happy was. I never knew happy. I never knew what it was to feel comfortable. How do you feel comfortable when you know you got stuff going on that nobody else should ever know, could ever know? Because if they ever knew what they'd think of you. How could you be comfortable trying to be somebody, match up, look right, be right, win? Enough. People use terms like words like enough. I never had enough. Enough what? Enough power, enough love, enough what? Praise, enough attention, enough money, enough anything. Ever. I never could fill this thing. So I felt okay. I didn't want to be anybody special. I didn't want to have to win anything. I just wanted to be okay. I kind of liked that word, comfortable, because I assumed it was okay. And the only time I ever came close to being uncomfortable is when I just had just enough to drink. And then for hours, sometimes it was just okay. And I was okay. And the fear was gone, and the feelings were gone, and the pressures were gone. And God, if I could just stay like that, I'd be like that all my life. And I'd never hurt anybody. I'd just be like that. It just doesn't work that way for us. It doesn't work that way for us. Now, when people come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and the newcomers, I'll do my old little trick before I sit down for you, and I'm going to leave you alone. They come in and they argue about what's this idea of powerlessness, or what's this idea about restore us to sanity, and what's this idea about our lives are unmanageable. Come on, give me a break. I mean, I drink too much, and there's some crap in my life, and I know I've done some things I shouldn't have done, but, I mean, you know, I go to work every day, and I do this, and I raise these kids, the woman says, and whatever. I want to argue. We don't have any room to argue in Alcoholics Anonymous. See, we don't have time to argue with anybody. You think anything you want. All we know is that we know the secret, and if you want to know the secret, you got to stick around to learn the secret. But in the meantime, there's nothing to argue about. I learned this little test, and I did it a few years ago for beginners, and it seems to work. I have a 4-year-old son, his grandson, and I have Danny's three, and Jimmy is 2. God, if he was Frankie, I'd know exactly when he was born. I say to my grandson, who's never seen a match, nobody smokes in my family. So I know there's never been a match lit in the front of Jimmy, Linda's boy. I know that to be true. And he loves Papa and trusts Papa. And if I walk up there tomorrow and I say, Jimmy, look what Papa has. Jimmy, come and touch this. You know what he would do, Patty? He'd touch it because he trusts Papa. And this is bright and shiny and attractive. You know what happened? He'd get burnt. He would get burnt, and he'd pull his hand away, and he'd run to Mommy, and he would cry. The next day I go there. I say, Jimmy, it's Papa. Jimmy, look what Papa has. Pat, do you think he'd touch it? Let's say he's not so bright. He is, and he wouldn't. But let's just play the newcomer game. Let's say he'd touch it again. It'd burn. He'd run to Mama. The next day, I would go there. I'd say, Jimmy, look what Papa has. He'd leave the room. Pat, I touched the match, and I got burned. The next day, I touched the match, and I got burned. 5 years later, I was still touching a match, and I was getting burned. 10 years later, I touched a match. I was still getting burned. Every time I got burned, I said, I don't want this to happen again. Hundreds of times I said, I'm done. No more. That's it. I mean it. I'm not going to live like this. And each time I lit another match, and each time I burnt myself. If a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old
could remember the pain. How is it that somebody who's in their 30s can't? I have no argument with unmanageable. I have no argument with insanity. I have no argument with my life being unmanageable or my powerlessness over what causes me to touch this match over and over and over again. Because almost every alcoholic I've ever met tried to stop and has stopped. And we find out when we stop drinking that drinking, the cessation of drinking, not drinking, the not drinking, sobriety is not the answer for the alcoholic. Because if you think that all the alcoholic should do is not drink and then they'll feel okay, I will tell you a secret. I always got drunk from sober. I was always sober before I got drunk. If being sober made me feel okay, I would never have had to get drunk. I already had it. I was sober. Thousands and thousands and thousands of mornings I was sober. For alcoholics, we drink because we can't stand sober, because the test tube and what's in that test tube hurts so bad, we must get relief. The thing about Alcoholics Anonymous that is so wonderful is simply this. Alcoholics Anonymous is a program of recovery by which we take certain actions, the effect of which is to do for us exactly what alcohol did for us. And it relieves, removes, or at least dilutes everything in our test tube. So when we come into Alcoholics Anonymous, we don't literally give anything up. We simply change what gives us the answer. In the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, there are actions that if we take that make fear go away, and anger go away, and self-centeredness go away, and there are really steps there and actions that even allow us to be human and to forgive ourselves. To realize that it's not important who, what you become, but what you are. And that most of us come and stay around here long enough to understand that our real job is not to be somebody, but it is to be a son. And that's a finer accomplishment than being a Supreme Court justice, being a good son, being a good daughter, being a good sister, being a good mother, being a good friend, being a human being who allows people to live in an imperfect life and them be imperfect too. I never could do that before Alcoholics Anonymous. I lived in a black and white world. I live in a world now where it's mostly shades of gray. I stayed here long enough to know the secret. I don't know the secret, Randy, if this is going to be true for you. But I have learned the secret of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have no reason to believe that if the secret is true for me, it can be for you. Here is the secret. God wants me to be safe. God wants me to be sane. God wants me to be happy. And God wants me to be sober. And when I'm in the presence of these people, I am the best me I have ever known. Thank you very much.